Whether you close your eyes or you keep them gently open in a downward gaze, choose either one, whatever supports you. Maybe shrugging the shoulders gently to the ears and then letting them slide down as a way to soften the body and arrive. Turning the awareness inward. Whether you're seated or standing or reclining, noticing the posture of the body, the places where it's touching whatever you're connected to, noticing the rise of the spine out of the deep low back to the crown of the head, tucking the chin ever so slightly to open the back of the neck if that's comfortable for you. And then softening the front of the body all the way from the forehead down through the face, the chest, the belly. Making some space to breathe. Just breathe and know you're breathing. Welcoming yourself into this time of practice in the company of others. Arriving and settling. Meeting this moment just as it is, just as you are. Just meeting it, arriving. And as we continue to arrive and settle into our practice together this morning, noticing if there's any intention that you have for your own practice, perhaps remembering why you came today. What was that motivation? What is it that keeps bringing you back to Sangha time after time? Or is there something more specific about this morning, this time, whether it's afternoon or evening, but about this practice time? Is there an intention for this moment? Just see what bubbles up. And there doesn't have to be, just an inquiry. And it's returning to the breath, the sense of sitting, standing, being as you are, meeting it. All right. Good morning and welcome back. I do love an arriving meditation. And if you've been here with me before or anywhere, you know that that's how we begin. I think it's just a lovely way to come into our practice and to settle. So last time I was here, which was about a month ago, I was talking about dukkha as a path to happiness. How do we take our, all the challenges of our lives and work with them as actually a necessary part of understanding our lives and moving into, when I say happiness, I mean this quality of okayness. And so I read you a story, which is a fictional story about a 92-year-old woman who was entering into an assisted living situation after her husband of 70 years had died, and she was just coming into this new time of her life. And it was, she was talking about what makes a happy life. And one of the pieces in it that has always struck me so deeply is that what she said is happiness is something you decide on ahead of time. And there was a discussion of whether she would like her new room and how it was set up. And she said, whether I like my room doesn't depend on how the furniture is arranged. It depends on how I arrange my mind. It depends on how I arrange my mind. She said, I already decided to love it. It's a decision I make every morning when I wake up. I have a choice. And that piece has been really important to me. I think it's so much of what our practice is about, is what is the arrangement or the rearrangement of our minds connected to our hearts always. So this is poignant for me right now because my in-laws, who are 89, live in a small town north of Milwaukee in Wisconsin, and both 89, and have been in an enormous transition in their lives. And right after I was here last time, my husband and I went to Wisconsin for my mother-in-law's 89th birthday. And she had been significantly ill for a couple of months, and she's much, much better now. Though she lives with a lot of memory loss, and she has gone from being critically ill to now being in an assisted living facility, and she is making friends with it. She's actually recognizing the losses. You know, she'll say things like, I've lost my independence, I've lost my memory, I've lost my home, and this place is wonderful. And this place is wonderful. And, you know, it's not easy to come to that. And there are many struggles. But I think she knows that piece of needing to rearrange her mind around it all the time, around the losses, around the difficulties, and to also see what is okay. So we went for her birthday. This was the first week of November, and then came back, and quite suddenly, a couple of days before Thanksgiving, her husband died, my father-in-law, who was also 89. So then we went back to Wisconsin with a different set of circumstances. Because we have a sense, I think that oftentimes we have a sense of what we think is going to be. And what we were all prepared for was for her death, because she'd been so sick. And she's just like an ever-ready battery. She's got some amazingly resilient genes, and she's doing incredibly well. And none of us expected my father-in-law to pass, and he did. And so then became the tricky territory of how to let my mother-in-law know that her husband had died and she has significant memory loss. So this has brought up for me a very interesting question, I think, from practice that I don't have the answer to at all, but it's something I am exploring, and I wonder if maybe some of you have explored this, is as aging happens, and as the mind changes and as the brain changes and memory loss occurs, what is it actually like to only primarily have present moment awareness? We talk so much in our practice about developing present moment awareness and not being lost in the past or lost in the future, but to really be present for our lives. So this is a very interesting experience for me to watch what's happening with the shrinking of the past, even 10 minutes ago, to living extremely, very, very present moment. And, you know, we need reference points. We do need memory serves in, you know, multitude of ways. So it was difficult over the course of a couple of days to have to keep reminding her of what had happened. And she knows now, you know, she's integrated it and heard it enough. And she's very, very smart and very present and knows what the deficits are in her memory. But it was, what we were doing was certainly acclimating and working with a whole new set of circumstances. How do we meet these transitions? How do we meet these struggles, the accommodation, the acclimation? This is all of our practice. I once heard a story about a woman who was had lost so much of her cognitive abilities that she had three words left. And then how she would respond to whatever the conversation was with one or all of these three words: precious, temporarily, unexpected. Precious, temporarily, and unexpected. And you know, it really struck me as that's really life, right? Isn't it? It's temporary. Everything is, you know, so many things are unexpected, and life is just so precious. So I never want to forget that. But the other thing that this has really brought for me, because this was, you know, all of this happened in a pretty short period of time, that we expected that she was at the end of her life, when in fact she is not. Yet it was her husband who was at the end of his life. And the preciousness of that, to not forget that, and how temporary all of this is. But the other thing that this is bringing up for me that I want to pose to you is coming into a deeper understanding and a deeper relationship with the languaging that we often use in our practice when we talk about turning towards what is difficult. I know you've heard that before. Turning towards what is difficult, or the astonishing capacity, which is how I've thought about this, of our hearts to hold both the joy and the sorrow, because that's true, right? We have joy, we have sorrow. We don't live on the extremes, we're in the middle of that, but our lives are made up of that. But instead of this is a nuanced thing, and I'm kind of picking at semantics, but I think it's valuable. This turning towards or holding both, I actually want to expand that and shift it to an experience of meeting whatever is here. Because if we can train in the meeting of it, that is the full range of experience. And I only need to show up and meet it as I can. I don't have to hold both. Maybe sometimes I can, maybe sometimes I can't, but I don't have to hold what isn't mine, the practice of knowing what is ours and what isn't ours. And I don't always have the capacity to literally turn towards that which is difficult. Sometimes I do. But I want to shift my relationship and understanding in our practice and give us all permission to work with that so much of our practice is about acclimating to what is difficult, what is unpleasant. But we don't have to turn towards it if we can't, if that's not where our resiliency is. But what we do is do our best to meet it. Because when we meet it with how we are at any given time. So going back to Sylvia's beautiful teaching, may I meet this moment fully. May I meet it as a friend. That has deeper meaning for me now, because I so appreciate that invitation to not have to hold what may be ungraspable or too hard, too heavy, too hot, but to meet my life and say, all right. So I offer that to you as your own reflection, your own practice place, and see if that resonates for you or not, or whether or not this is just, you know, me being picky about semantics. Maybe it all means the same thing, but it actually doesn't mean the same thing to me as I practice with it. And this is one of the very beautiful parts of, I think, our explorations, is that we show up to it as we can, and we have the authority inside ourselves to meet these different aspects of practice as we can, and to interpret it in a way that works for us. And you might think, oh, well, that's cherry picking, and that's really not staying close to the tradition of the teaching, or the orthodoxy of the Buddhist tradition. I don't think we have to. And I think what the injunction is, the task is, to find a way through all of these different teachings to take the ones that really help you transform your relationship to suffering into a way that you can be with what is difficult, that you can meet it. So take what resonates and leave the other parts behind. So then, to take this meeting, how to meet this moment fully, we come with a kind heart, that we train in this kind-heartedness. But then we can work with these two very important questions that give us the capacity to meet the difficulty and to meet also possibility, what actually can be there, the love, the beauty. A friend of mine wrote to me and said, oh my gosh, Heidi, this sounds like such a terribly difficult time. I hope you're taking time to notice beauty. And it was really helpful to me, because we can be so overwhelmed and caught in the difficult that we do forget to notice the beauty. And we talk about that in this practice all the time, how important it is. And even though I talk about it in this role of a teacher, I still need the reminder too. I am the same as everybody else. I need that reminder to notice beauty. So we can use these two questions. The first question is, what is still true? Well, what is still true is, my mother-in-law has lost most of her memory, and her husband, and her house, all of her life the way she knew it for a very long time. But what else is true? This is a wonderful place, she says. The people are so nice here. It is so clean. They take such good care of me. That's what else is true. What else is true? There was this moment, unfortunately, my father-in-law died 2 days before my mother-in-law's planned move into this assisted living. And so it complicated it dramatically. But we still had to do this move. And my husband is one of five kids, four men, one woman. And they're not kids, you know, they're all in their 60s. So we call them the kids. But I walked into this new little apartment where my mother-in-law will be, and there were these four men decorating it. it was such a sweet moment. They were hanging pictures and putting doilies out and all of this stuff, these four men in their 60s. And I was just so taken with their love for mom. And that is what else is true. You know, here, what is still true is all of the difficulty, but we're meeting it. We're meeting it with this love. And that holds it. That holds it. So here's a poem I came across. It's called Joey by Brian Doyle. A while ago, I got sick. It was a thorough and major sick. Lost use of the old hands and feet, which was, as you can imagine, weird. My kids called the sickness the thing. I could tell you lots of stories about the thing, but there's only one story that I want to tell you. Every morning, my son got up early to help me put my socks on. I would sit on the back stairs in the dark, and he would wrestle my socks on, and neither of us would say any words, and I still can't think of anything cooler than that. I have racked my brains and considered all the possibilities of love, and I still return to that boy and those socks. No matter what happens to me, that happened to me. Isn't that beautiful? Notice the love. Notice the love. So let's move into our meditation now. And once again, finding a posture that supports you, that feels good in your body. As Jack Kornfield would say, find a position, a seat right here between heaven and earth. And then he'll go on to say this beautiful invocation to practice. Oh, nobly born, you who are the sons and daughters of the awakened ones, remember the luminous nature of your mind, the goodness of your heart. Trust it. Return to it. It is home. May we meet this moment fully. May we meet it as a friend. Finding that place in your own body where you can settle, noticing the touch points, the backs of the thighs, the bottom, the back, even noticing where the hands are touching, whether they're clasped or in the lap. Noticing the touch of the tongue in the mouth. Perhaps the lips and the eyelids. And holding just enough energy in the back of the body to stay attentive and awake. Softening everything else. So you can breathe and the mind can settle. Sensing into that place where you feel your breath the most obviously. Perhaps it's the belly or the chest or the nostrils. Acquainting yourself again with the experience of breathing. And wherever you'd like to rest your awareness, to gently let your attention meet experience, whether it's the breath or the body, or phrases, may I meet this moment fully, may I meet it as a friend, whatever it is, choose that place that works most naturally for you and try to stay there. Come back when the mind wanders, as it will, beginning again, gently and persistently, and with kindness. Let's sit quietly. If you're noticing any holding in the body, maybe the jaw, the throat, the shoulders, or the belly or chest, see if you can soften that area, releasing any tension or constriction that you can, bringing some fresh softening breath to that space, releasing any amount. Noticing any amount of stillness, ease, or relaxation that is arising in the body and in the heart and the mind. And letting that ease, letting that stillness be in the forefront, letting it support you. Not over-efforting, not striving for any outcome, but a meeting and an allowing with whatever is here. And if there is some stillness or ease, really let that be in the front. Let it support you. Front of mind, I mean, but supporting your entire being, letting it pervade you. And now drawing the awareness into the heart center, the area of the center of the chest and the upper back, sensing into the state of heart, meeting it just as it is, allowing it to belong, to have it, have the heart be just the heart. As we quiet the mind, oftentimes the heart softens a little bit, shows up a little more, becomes a little more spacious, sturdy even. And we'll move into this practice of the heart's breath. If you'd like, this is your choice. Imagining as you inhale, drawing in fresh, nurturing breath and energy from every direction into the heart space, from behind and in front of the heart, above and below, sides and diagonals. Sometimes I like to put my hand on my chest. Gives me the felt sense of this heart space. You can do that if you like. Breathing in this nurturing breath and energy, and as you exhale back out into every direction, the heart softens, becomes a little more spacious, maybe energized. You might try that for a few breath cycles, breathing in and out of this heart, the heart's breath. I find that this practice reminds me to lead with my heart whenever possible, to trust my heart's inclination. Here's another poem for you called Kindness by Rosemary Wattola Traumer. Consider the tulip, how long ago someone's hands planted a bulb and gave to this place a living scrap of beauty, how it rises every spring out of the same soil, which is, of course, not at all the same soil, but new. It is this way with kindness. Someone plants in someone else a bit of beauty, a kind word, perhaps, or a touch, the gift of their time or their smile. And years after, in that inner soil, that beauty emerges again, pushing aside the dead leaves, insisting on loveliness, a celebration of the one who planted it, the one who perceives it, and the fertile place where it has grown. May our hearts be a fertile place that grows kindness. And now we'll move into our practice of metta, this offering of kindness and goodwill out to anyone we think of who would benefit from it, and certainly we benefit from it. And anybody who wishes to say out loud a blessing for someone you're thinking of, we'll all have the ability to just unmute and do that. And I'll begin. I do want to offer love and kindness to all those who are touched by memory loss and how that affects themselves and those who love them. Who are you thinking of?
I'm thinking of my sister-in-law, who is entering a memory care assisted living unit today. And so this is so apropos, and also my brother, who is suffering from Mentra, and may they find acceptance and see the place as being wonderful. Holding both hands.
I'd like to offer metta to everybody in my grief group who's lost their mate in this last year.
Metta to my friend Marilyn, who just had surgery to repair an aortic aneurysm. May she recover enough so that she can make the trip across country to stay with her daughter where she needs to be to recuperate because she lives all alone in a remote area in Northern California. I hope she gets to go where she wants, when she wants.
I offer metta to all the people and all the animals who are losing their homes and their livelihood in the horrendous flooding that's happening in southern BC and also in other places in the world. Bless
you. Tom.
Today's teaching from you was very appropriate for me as well. My sister has Alzheimer's disease and it's very advanced. Sometimes, you know, we Zoom on Wednesday mornings, and like today, she just was staring.
Mm-hmm.
And your teaching has helped me to face this and to
yeah. So hard. Yeah,
I know.
It's just so hard.
Yeah, because both my parents also had Alzheimer's disease, so in the back of my mind there's kind of guilt, you know, that it's passed me by, but like I said, today's teaching was just perfect. Thank you so much
Tom. Yeah, it's a painful time. Who else?
I'm sending that to my aunt, who is also suffering from Alzheimer's disease, and who is living alone.
Uh-huh. Wow, that's a big deal, Audrey. Yeah, it's a big deal. Isn't this remarkable how much this touches so many of us? And this poignancy of how alone we can feel, but we're really not. So when we bring these topics up in Sangha and we can talk with each other about it, I know that each one of our personal experiences it's a mix, right, of the beauty and the sorrow and the difficulty, the practical day-to-day difficulty of this is all true. And we really aren't alone. Because when we can say, oh, you too, then each one of our own experiences that is difficult gets held in a bigger space. And so you can remember this, and you can go back to the recording that will be on Dharma Seed that maybe will be helpful going forward. And we're going to talk a lot more after the break, too. So thank you, everybody. Thank you, thank you. Let's take 5 minutes for a short break, and we'll come back at 7 after the hour. Thank you. Okay, then. So a couple years ago, I was taking some retreat time in a cabin in the mountains. This time of year, actually, is one of my favorite times of the year to take a break and spend time in retreat with the shorter days and just this time of year. And I was in this cabin with this fireplace that I needed to figure out how to effectively build a fire for heat. And it was great. I was really enjoying myself. And through that time of quiet, I had this sense of that there were three things I needed to do. What came out of that retreat were some very strong intentions that just really came up for me. And I want to talk about this today because they feel like ongoing tasks, ongoing places for learning. And maybe you have felt these same things, but there were three things that came up for me as the task going forward. One, to dissolve contention. The second, forgive everyone. And the third one, wake up. Dissolve contention, forgive everyone, and wake up. So that's a tall order. I know that's a tall order, but it is just really what came up. And I thought, okay, that's why I'm in this practice. And I don't think I really have the expectation that I'm going to figure it all out. But I do keep coming back to this practice, and I'm in it because I would like to meet that. I would like to learn what that requires of me, to learn to dissolve contention when that comes up, to move into that place of understanding the depths of suffering that any of us can experience at any time. So that quality of forgiveness is a deep understanding and the continual practice of waking up. How do we let go to stop struggling against anything? How do we cultivate empathy and understanding to be fully present? I think it takes a tremendous amount of strength and steadiness and courage and persistence and giving up and coming back and giving up and coming back. All of it, just really being deeply human. I once heard Sylvia say, every moment of mindfulness is a moment of kindness. And every moment of kindness is a moment of mindfulness. Have you heard her say that before, that teaching? It's really wonderful. Let's take it apart a little bit. Every moment of mindfulness is a moment of kindness, and every moment of kindness is a moment of mindfulness. How I relate to that and how I understand it is that if we define mindfulness as seeing clearly and knowing what's going on, knowing what's what, presence of mind, it requires a kind heart to be willing to meet whatever is here. Because a resistant, closed off heart probably can't see clearly. Probably there's some fog in the way. But a truly kind heart makes us open and willing to be with whatever it is, this mindfulness. And a moment of kindness is a moment of mindfulness, because when we show up with this inclination towards warmth, to be a force for good, it requires seeing clearly. So it's two sides of the same coin. And I've heard, I think it was Ajahn Brahm, who is a teacher in Australia, he calls it kindfulness. It's cute, kindfulness. But I think it's true. So if we start from that basic premise of mindfulness plus kindness actually equals what Ram Dass taught, loving awareness, that gives us the strength to work, to practice, to dissolve contention, to forgive everyone. It is a practice of waking up. So let's talk about dissolving contention. How does contention work? You know, we all have preferences. What do we like? What do we not like? I don't want it to be like this, but it is like this. Anytime we are rejecting anything, is got some amount of contention in it, right? We don't want it to be like this. And I am not saying that we shouldn't have boundaries. We shouldn't have limits. We're not going to like everything. This is not what I mean by this. What I mean is to be able to be in relationship with anything, whether we like it or not, but to be able to be present with it. So we don't want to have the active contention that causes reactivity that is the suffering. That's the distinction that I'm making. You don't have to like everything. None of us is going to like everything. That's not what I'm suggesting. But I am suggesting that we don't have to be in an argument with things that are uncomfortable. We can train in meeting the discomfort. And I think that this is what the Buddha was talking about with the Four Noble Truths, right? That life includes suffering for sure. And there's a cause, our grasping, our clinging, our wanting things to be other than they are. And it doesn't have to be like that. We actually cannot be in contention. That's this third noble truth, that the mind can subside, that in the subsiding of the mind, we can say, all right, this is what is true. This is what is going on. Then we have a lot of agency to meet it and to be with whatever that is. We don't have to make a difficult thing more difficult. A lot of these teachings and adages that I come back to all the time, and that is one of them, to not make a difficult thing more difficult. And it's easy for that to happen because things can be really difficult. And this is why we need those questions about what else is true. What else is true? It helps take the sting out. Remembering that struggle is extra, for sure. Life is hard enough as it is. And I think that space between the second noble truth, that there's a cause of our suffering, which is this imperative in the mind that things should be a certain way, or our grasping and clinging, and the third noble truth that says peace is possible, there actually is an end to the suffering. I think it's right in that space between the second and the third truth that is so pithy. Have you ever felt that place where you were caught in something and then you go, oh yeah, and it releases? If you've had that experience of the release, you know what I mean. And we were talking about this, like as we were talking about what is it like to be with someone we love who has memory loss? If we are in contention with the reality of that, it gets in the way of being with it, of just being with that person. And as Tom said, when somebody is just staring ahead, it's uncomfortable, it's sad, it's painful, it's all of that, but we show up. And in the showing up, that's where there's some space. There's some freedom in that because we're saying, yeah, I'm meeting this. And the fourth noble truth, the Eightfold Path, gives us ways to practice with whatever there is, with any amount of contention. It helps us, I think, take a lot of responsibility for our lives. And what I mean by that, by taking responsibility for our lives, I don't mean that we take on the whole world. I mean that we, again, show up for it and say it's like this. And this Eightfold Path gives us so many tools, so many resources as a way to be in relationship with when contention arises, with the ability to be free of the contention. So just to briefly go over the Eightfold Path begins with wise understanding, which includes the Four Noble Truths and the truth of karma, that this happens because this happens, because of this, that, the truth of there is a consequence to every action. Every action creates a ripple effect. Interconnection, that's another way to think about it. So that is the first path factor. All of these, I want to say, are interconnected. And even though they're often given in an order, I think that, you know, that can be a circle, it can be a spiral, it can be any shape. Wise intention is the next path factor that includes metta and compassion and renunciation. Wise speech, of course, is what we say, what we strive for, what we are developing is speech that is truthful and helpful, comes from a kind heart and is timely. Wise action, the commitment towards living a life of non-harming and studying non-harming ongoing. Wise livelihood, engaging in our lives again from a place of non-harming. And this was originally taught as, how do we earn a living? Does it cause harm? Is it a cause for flourishing? And wise effort, which I'll talk a little bit more about, knowing and working with wholesome and unwholesome mind states and patterns. And this is how we come back to this piece of dissolve contention. Because if we can notice in the mind, the ugh, in the mind, the clench, where does that take us? And what we want to do with wise effort is be able to clearly see the habits of mind. What are these difficult states that arise? What can we do to subdue them, to shift them? What can we do to prevent mind states from arising that really don't support us? And what can we do when we're in a good place to enhance that? That's wise effort. And wise mindfulness, looking deeply, seeing clearly, knowing what's going on. And then wise concentration, this practice of our meditation, the samadhi, steadying the mind, the gathered and collected mind, so we can see clearly, so our efforts are wise, so we make choices that are for our well-being and those around us. And I think what happens through all these practices is contention naturally starts to ease. We are less likely to be in contention because we understand that difficulty is part and parcel to living this life. So we don't need to be in an argument with it. We need to meet it. We need to do our best to meet it without railing against it. And so that's what I mean when I think about dissolve contention. I don't want to rail against the circumstances that come up in my life. I want to have the stability and the capacity to say, oh man, this is really tough. I don't want it to be like this, but I don't have to rail against it. And that's the piece that I want to learn that came out of that retreat around dissolving contention. I also want to know when I've got, you know, when my mind goes into an unkind place, to notice how that affects my whole being. Sylvia once said also, when I do not have disparaging thoughts, I'm a happier person. Isn't that true? When I do not have disparaging thoughts, I'm a happier person. That's the other reason I want to do this, because I don't want to have disparaging thoughts. And I will, because I'm human. But I do want to catch them before they get too sour. I really do want to do that. I don't want to be in an argument with myself. Shinzen Young, a wonderful teacher in Los Angeles, he says, do not fight with yourself at any level. Do not fight with yourself at any level. Now, all of these are practices. I don't think that we can necessarily take on any of these teachings and just say, okay, got it, thanks. It's not how this works, right? This is a task of a lifetime, and it asks us to be patient and kind with ourselves. So as we do this, and as I work with when my mind is contentious, that I start seeing the truth of impermanence through the dukkha, the truth of the interconnection and the karma, that it will change. Right now, this might be how my heart and mind are. It may feel a little sour or difficult. And I have these tools and these practices to work with it. And it will change. The beauty of impermanence. It really is the beauty of impermanence. Sour moods are not the only thing in us. So that's a relief also. And then what happens is I have more courage and more capacity to let go. This is this letting go, the renunciation that happens when we can see that things will change, that this is a natural process. My heart might be hurting, or my heart may be full of joy, but I'm okay wherever that is, even in the most difficult times. So it's a practice. I saw this really great cartoon this morning on Sharon Salzberg's social media. Carlita, could you bring it up for us, please? Thanks. So check that out. Look at this octopus. Isn't that beautiful? Me learning to let go. Just one arm. I'm doing it. I'm doing it. So can we be patient with ourselves? Right? Like just take one sucker off at a time. Just one. Doesn't have to be the whole kit and caboodle. It's easier that way. This really is a lifetime of practice. Suzuki Roshi says that true renunciation is not giving up things of the world, but knowing they go away. I think that's really beautiful. True renunciation is not giving up things of the world, but knowing they go away, including the discursive mind, including, you know, the difficult states, and the sweet states also shift. So this letting go, this easing, it's a natural process. The more we cultivate this caring heart and this kind mind, this clear mind, I think we start seeing the big picture. We see the big picture of loss and grief and joy and birth, all of it. I once heard a story about from Ajahn Chah, who was the teacher of Jack Kornfield, and he was teaching his students, and he was out on a walk, and there are these boulders in a field, boulders, big boulders of different sizes, small ones, big ones, medium-sized ones, and he pointed to one of the small ones and said to his students, "So look at that boulder over there, that small one in the corner out by that tree. Do you think it's heavy?" And they said, "No, it doesn't look heavy." And he said, "No, it's probably not very heavy." And then he looked at a couple other ones that were medium-sized, and he said, "What about those? Are those heavy?" And they said, "Well, it might be a little bit heavy." And then he looked at a huge boulder and said, "Now, what about that one over there?" And they said, "Oh, yeah, we could never pick that up. It's way too big." And he said, "Not if you don't pick it up. It isn't heavy if you don't pick it up." Now, this is an interesting teaching, I think, because it isn't saying you don't have to carry or take responsibility for something that is really hard. And you could hear it that way, because some of us have got enormous challenges and they have different, you know, at different times. And you might think, that is really, you know, what can I do? I have this huge boulder I'm carrying around because of some enormous challenge in my life. Don't tell me not to pick it up. I don't have a choice. This is what's in my life. So please don't hear it like that. The way I hear this story is knowing our capacity at any given time and taking this kind of radical responsibility for our lives so we can engage with what is necessary, but we don't take on the burden of the world. We can't. And I think that's what he was pointing to. Do what you can, but don't take on what doesn't make sense for who you are today. Are you with me on this? And this is also part of how we move into the dissolving of the contention and forgiving others, forgiving ourselves for who we are. What is mine? What is not mine? And some of us are people pleasers. Some of us are rescuers. And we get burned out. And we get compassion burnout. And so we learn to titrate our exposures and what we can take on. And when we need to pull back to restore ourselves, we do. And this also helps with these components of not being in contention with our lives, understanding and cultivating empathy and the process of waking up. So the different kinds of renunciation, different kinds of letting go. There's the letting go of stuff, right? The material accumulation or experiences, noticing the graspiness that can be inside of us. We all have that. Knowing what is enough, knowing when it's not enough, or where are we on that continuum line of enoughness between prosperity and scarcity. And we all float in a different, you know, along that line at different times. And it could be depending on our upbringing and our conditioning. Some of us have been raised with a lot of scarcity, some with a lot of prosperity. And it changes our view. It changes our relationship to how we see the world, what is possible for us. I know one person who grew up with his mother counting the slices of bread for the week, counting the pieces of fruit for the week for all the kids. So there was only exactly one's portion. There was no extra. So what that did is set this person up for there's never enough. There's never enough. When in fact, as this person grew and came into his own life, there was always more than enough. But it's hard to see it. It's hard to see it if that's your conditioning. So when you come into this place of knowing that you're basically okay, this enoughness, we start to let go. Lao Tzu said, "One who knows that enough is enough will always have enough." One who knows that enough is enough will always have enough. I appreciate that teaching a lot because in my moments of fear, and I think that it's moments of fear that makes me graspy, that, what if I don't have enough? What if there isn't? What do I need to do to keep myself secure? It's very rich practice because it touches on all of these places. So we can learn to let go of things and stuff and be in relationship with our own orientations towards enough. Sometimes in the practice of renunciation, we have to let go of people, relationships, friendships that don't serve anymore. That's painful. I think that can be really painful. And when we hold on tightly and things change because they do, if we are holding on to that rope that is changing and we don't release, we get rope burn, right? That's that place of contention. I don't want to hold on so tightly that I get burned by my own graspiness. Or, you know, with the same thing of people, how we want others to be. As meditators, maybe we have partners who aren't meditators. Does it matter? Do we want them to be a certain way? What are their practices for stabilizing, for stability, for clarity, for kindness? My husband is a gardener. He's not a meditator. And his gardening is his meditation. What he gets out of that, I think, is the same thing that I get out of this practice. So can we give enough space to others in our lives for them to be who they are? We don't need to remake anybody into ourselves. That's a part of forgiveness, of understanding, of dissolving contention, of waking up. So then what about views? How do we work with other views and limiting beliefs? The problem with fixed views, right? Does it lead to ill will? Does it lead to rejection of other? Can we let go of the need to be right? That one's not easy. But can we let go of that to say, well, you know, there's more than one truth. There's more than one way to look at things. And when it isn't our way of looking at things, it can be uncomfortable. Where I was in Wisconsin, it was a small town, kind of like Mayberry, about an hour north of Milwaukee, and there are a lot of flags there that are flying that say Trump won. And I don't actually believe that, but it was very interesting to be in a place where that is the predominant belief. So what did that set up in me? I needed to work with that. The Buddha famously said, "Those who cling to their views go about the world annoying others." Those who cling to their views go about the world annoying others. So when are we annoying? You know, if we think we're right and we have a certain view, you know, we got to be careful. Because we really can be annoying. And others can really be annoying to us. So again, like, let's not be in contention. Let's say, yeah, there are, what is true for me may not be true for you. There is not some truth authority, although some people think there is. We do need to cultivate this kind heart, I believe. And I do believe that we do need to study non-harming, so we cause the least amount of harm possible towards ourselves and others through all of these different things we're talking about. You know, the end of the Metta Sutta, the Buddha's teachings on loving kindness, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, is not born again into this world. I understand that to mean the not born again into this world, that we don't keep creating the same cycles of suffering over and over again. We learn. We learn from our ways, and we cultivate more love, more capacity, the ability to tolerate, to be with varying views. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, is not born again into this world. And this is the meaning of our lives, the ability to say, right now it's like this. And back to this piece, that life is precious, it is unexpected, it is temporary. Rachel Naomi Raymond said, "I have let go of my preferences and am living with an intense awareness of the miracle of the moment." I've let go of my preferences and I'm living with an intense awareness of the miracle of the moment. And I think sometimes we get a glimpse of that when things are really hard. When they're really, really hard. We're on the brink of losing someone we love or we have. And we get it. All of a sudden, we really get it, how precious and temporary and unexpected life is. Can we let go of fear? That's another aspect of this renunciation. Maybe, maybe not. There's a lot that's frightening. But oftentimes, fear is about the future. And so just notice when fear arises. What are you noticing in your body or your heart or your mind? Is it controlling you? Is it making you not able to function thoroughly in your life? Can we trust life enough? Are we willing to fail? Fear is tricky. So forgive everyone. Notice grudges. Notice the judgmental mind, the judgmental heart, the armored heart, to learn to practice understanding. And I think of forgiveness as a very deep well of understanding, the depth of knowing that causes, conditions, more causes, more conditions create whatever is going on. And when we see that so-and-so might be behaving in a way that is painful to us, it's oftentimes not about us, it's about them. It's about their experience, their conditions, what's happened for them. And in that way, I think forgiveness can arise when we forgive life itself. I remember one time Larry Yang, a teacher at Spirit Rock, was talking about forgiveness practice. Not only do we forgive ourselves, Do we forgive others? Do we ask for understanding? But can we forgive life itself for the truth of suffering? It can be a hard thing to do, but I think this is all part of this big practice. So the practice of forgiveness, we could talk about it for a very long time, but we do need to cultivate the heart. We do need to cultivate kindness and compassion, to know joy, cultivate this equanimity, because then it strengthens us. It gives us a phenomenally deep foundation to be in our lives with all of the joy, all of the sorrow. Norman Fisher says, strengthen your ability to face with love whatever happens next. I think that's what we're doing. Strengthen your ability to face with love whatever happens next. And this is the practice of awakening, the wake up. We get these moments, many times of deeper and deeper understanding. And I think that's what awakening is. We have experiences of love and understanding and letting go that change us, that we can't not know. And when we get to these places where we know something, that we know it with a capital K, that we really know it, I think that's a moment of awakening, because it changes us. It sticks with us. Deeper and deeper awareness. I have a lot more I want to share with you, but I'm realizing that I've been talking for a while, and I'd like to see what you think about all of this.